You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 18th to the 24th of June 2015. My name is John Elms and today I'm joined by books editor Karen Shook and reporters Jack Grove and Chris Havergal. Universities are not doing enough to tackle a widespread lad culture of excessive drinking and lewd behaviour on campus. That's according to the sector's ombudsman. Jack will be bringing us up to speed on that a little later. Government spending cuts and immigration policies, if applied bluntly, risk causing a car crash in higher education policy. That's another view of a sector heavyweight, Sir Steve Smith, the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Exeter and former Universities UK President. Chris, you'll be taking the lead on that one. And finally, Karen will be giving us a comprehensive rundown of all the works featured in her chock-a-block book section this week, and that will be a little later. Before that, though, Jack, you have a story about a topic that's plagued the global sector, let alone the UK sector, a lag culture. What's the story?
Well, we've heard a lot about some of the bad behaviour seen on campuses, and there's been some incidents recently involving, I'm thinking of LSE's rugby club made some rather unfortunate comments, and it's something that's seen lots of different campuses, but it's seldom actually raised by sort of real, as you say, heavyweight figures within the within the sector. But Rob Berrens is the chief executive of the Office of the Independent Adjudicator for Higher Education. He goes around all the universities in Britain, in England, and he speaks to student unions. And he said that, you know, it's a real problem, and student unions are concerned about it. It's very prevalent. It's damaging, you know, people's time at university. It's not at all pleasant. Universities aren't properly set up to deal with some of the problems when they arise. They're maybe not tackling some of the sort of the root causes of this sort of behaviour. And he spoke about some of the complaints that he's had to deal with.
Yeah.
Because when universities and students can't reach an agreement on certain complaints, they go to the Office of the Independent Adjudicator, and he's sort of described some quite shocking incidents, and he said that universities need to get a grip.
Yeah, no, I mean, he goes to say that it's not just an isolated problem within a certain group of universities. It's quite prevalent in all the institutions I visit, so it's clearly an issue for the whole sector, not just certain institutions where it might be seen to be a bit more common. I don't know why particularly. I mean, this is across the board, as it were.
Yeah, he said it's not a few isolated incidents. The cases coming to him are relatively small, but he's talking about a wider drink culture he sees, which leads to a lot of complaints by students, and just some things that just student levels of acceptable behaviour that some students just aren't really getting.
Yeah,
it's an interesting one, really, in terms of it coming out in the form of complaints to the adjudicator, when in the past some people might have thought that what students get up to in the sort of bars and nightclubs of their sort of university city, you know, by that stage the university has sort of washed their hands of them. But it does seem that it's actually something that's coming back to bite the institutions themselves.
Yeah, that is an interesting point, because where does the private lives of students start and where does their time at university start? And the two are very intertwined, and often it's this behaviour is taking place on university premises or nearby. There's incidents at sort of formal dinners and related to student societies. And I think basically students have to realise that they have to be accountable to their university for some of their actions while they're, you know, they're part of that university, and that message maybe isn't really communicated as strongly as it could be.
Mm. Maybe the OIA complaints are an identifiable metric, and there are a lot of other, you know, less formal complaints or complaints being made other places, but this is a national body where we can look at and see that. Mm. It doesn't seem intuitive that would be the first place you would take.
If you compared it to other 18 to 21 year olds, for example, in the company. Obviously, there's not really a way of doing that because there's not an adjudicator to go to
for Larry
Hughes outside of the university. But I mean, he does make the point that that it's quite this where does it become a university matter and where it's just a people outside of university's clutches, as it were. But he makes quite strident comments about universities falling short of, not preparing their students with the information with what to do when they do get harassed. I mean, that seems pretty bad on a university's part. If you go to them with a harassment case because it happened on university premises, that would make perfect sense for a student. Mm. And then universities, essentially, he seems to be saying that some universities don't know what to tell them in terms of where to put the complaint.
Well, it's tricky because staff need to be trained to this, but then should police be involved? These people might be living together in the same halls of residence. So how do you sort of separate the complainant and the person who's allegedly done these things? What's the investigation procedure? How do you what are the sanctions? Have those sanctions been told to students? Are they aware of them? Are they told that they can't just get legless or in their halls of residence or in and around university property? It's an interesting one.
I mean, it's surprising to hear that universities aren't taking it seriously, because we've got all this talk about
reputational damage, and you look at the United States, the ongoing concerns about sexual assault, rape, other things going on, and the feeling that the university really wanted to make sure nobody knew about this because it could damage their reputation, but weren't for fulfilling their legal and moral duty to address these issues.
Well, exactly. Well, Rob Byrne's comments have clearly thrown up and up a really important matter that I'm sure the sector will be wanting as a whole to address in the near future.
Maybe we need a league table.
Yes, we can make contact. Yeah.
Least threatening offensive university culture.
Right, well, that story is on page 6 and 7 of the magazine, if you're keen to read more of Rob Barron's comments. And now we have a story on some more strident comments from another prominent figure in the sector. Chris, Sir Steve Smith, you've been talking to him. What's he been saying?
Yeah, this followed a conference where Sir Steve, who's the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Exeter, was speaking last week. His main argument is that over the course of this Parliament, the likelihood is that the UK higher education sector is going to become a lot less homogeneous. A couple of drivers behind that. One is funding. We've heard a lot recently about the funding cuts, which look to be coming the way of the university sector. And certainly Sir Steve's case is that when you're looking to make cuts of that sort of magnitude, it's unlikely that the Treasury is going to apply equally across the board. Mm. They're going to be looking at universities which are seen as sort of vital to the country's vital to the country's research effort, and may treat them differently when it comes to cuts to institutions which perhaps are known for their widening participation efforts. The second element of differentiation, in Steve Smith's view, is likely to be around immigration, and this is potentially where the car crash, which he describes, comes in. You've got Joe Johnson on one side looking to increase education exports to $30 billion. That's Joe Johnson, the universities minister. On the other hand, you've got Theresa May, the Home Secretary, looking to reduce immigration. If differentiation is again the solution which the government looks to, you could see some of the universities which, because of funding cuts, have to rely even more on international students for income, being the very same institutions which are being restricted more in terms of how they can recruit.
So is he saying, I'm reading between the lines, is he saying that there's an element of loggerheads in government?
I think
the sector's going to be a victim of that.
Yeah, the debates in the last parliament were well known, and with Theresa May remaining at the Home Office, I think that remains equally the case, and perhaps even more so with Joe Johnson, being renowned or sort of certainly having a reputation as someone with an international and certainly a European perspective. I mean, what Steve Smith's case is that if there is going to be differentiation, and he's not making the case for it, he's saying that it looks like it's inevitable that it's going to happen, If there is going to be differentiation in terms of immigration, it should be based on objective standards such as visa application refusal rates of universities, and not on some blunt tools such as membership of a mission group, which could see, you know, a lot of universities which rely on that funding to do an important job losing out.
Absolutely, and presumably he met, you know, as a quite a well-known person in the sector, you know, he's making these, he's, as you say, he's not making case for it, he's just kind of saying that there needs to be a careful, nuanced conversation about the different what different institutions will need.
Yeah, and he says it goes, you know, much deeper into the sector than the sort of two examples of funding and immigration that I've raised. He talks about the student loan book and the possibility of different universities buying their own student sections of the student loan book, and how there will be widespread variation in how attractive those are to investors depending on the outcomes of your graduates. And also on quality assurance, again, a lot of debate about the future of the QIA recently. We could well see a system where different universities have very different quality assurance regimes imposed on them depending on sort of how well they've performed in the past. So the sort of one size fits all approach, which has, you know, perhaps been seen in recent years, maybe a thing of the past.
Absolutely. We'll see. We'll see whether his warnings will be taken on board in the future. Karen, a chock block book section. What do you have for us?
Indeed, a torrent of text again this week. There are some pretty fantastic books in this week's issue. Everybody talks about big data. Every scholar dreams of uncovering a treasure trove of big data. Some of you may be familiar with Middletown, which is what the sociologists Robert and Helen Lind called Muncie, Indiana. They studied it in depth. As luck would have it, incredible coincidence, when the public library in Muncie, Indiana was being renovated about a decade ago, in a leaky attic where pigeons had been nesting, some researchers found ledgers of 175,000 borrowers from the public library, not only the membership list, but what they borrowed from 1891 to 1902. So there you have it, big data covered with pigeon poop. And the authors Frank Felsenstein and James Connolly have given perhaps the first look at that, what Middletown read, print culture in an American small city. One of my favorite things is the borrowing records of the tourist club in the city, which was a group of middle-class women in Muncie who didn't actually travel, but they read books about it and talked about what was great. Maybe it wasn't genteel enough, the idea of going to parts foreign. Also this week, the very eminent historian Robert Galatly reviews Peter Longerich's book, Goebbels, A Biography. Now, we've written about this in the news section because Goebbels' family were suing the author for his use of quotations of Goebbels' speeches and diaries, of course. An issue of concern if historians have to think about the people they are quoting, Nazis or otherwise. Also this week, Helen Bynum reviews Bad Faith, When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. This is a book by Paul Offit, who's a distinguished academic pediatrician, talking about a measles epidemic from 89 to 91 in Philadelphia and the various religious groups who did not seek treatment. He's considering the issues involved there. I'm also really excited this week to have Jessie Strive make her debut as a reviewer for us. She's a young sociologist at Duke University who is a recent Book of the Week author. She wrote a book called The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages. Here she reviews a book called Driving After Class, Anxious Times in an American Suburb, the idea that once you've made it in the American dream, and of course there are plenty of studies that suggest that that's no longer quite so possible as it once was, what are the anxieties about, is it good enough to have an SUV if you haven't got a Porsche? Should you spend the money on patio furniture to impress your guests and not worry about what goes on indoors? So she did. The author of this book, Rachel Hyman, did an in-depth study of a small group of people and their anxieties. And the Book of the Week author, my lecturers at university would be proud of me. I have actually exchanged emails with Helen Bendler. I cannot think of a more eminent critic of poetry. And her book, The Ocean, the Bird, and the Scholar, Essays on Poets and Poetry, is our Book of the Week this week. Elizabeth Green, fellow academic and poet, reviews it. The doyenne, the dean, the capo di tutti capi of literary critics, Helen Vendler, began by studying mathematics, and when she was admitted to Harvard's PhD program, not after a few difficulties to study literature, the chairman of the department told her, "You know we don't want you here, Miss Hennessy. We don't want any women here." So pleased to hear, it may have had something to do with her tendency to cry. She hasn't told us that. Fortunately, she did leave the sciences. And she's told me that when I asked her a few questions about seeing the places that poets were raised, she said, yes, indeed, she has, unlike the women of Muncie, Indiana, traveled to Yeats's Ireland, Wordsworth's Lake District. And she said that when she was young, she thought it was fine to teach Yeats without ever seeing where he had been. But she was glad to have been taken there. And interestingly, she says, seeing Emily Dickinson's house in Amherst made me realize that she was rich. And seeing Walt Whitman's house in Camden made me realize he was poor. Any of you who have had your reading of John Keats' Illuminated or Wallace Stevens or many others will want to read this review in this book.
It's a great review, and it's definitely made me want to read the book. I mean, Helen Vendler.
I know. I know. Insane. I've exchanged emails with her. I can retire.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Karen's given us the most comprehensive view of her book session, and I thoroughly recommend reading it, all of it. It's fantastic, especially the Helen Vendler book review. It's had me captivated, and I am an English literature graduate, so maybe that's the reason why.
I'll give you your email address for a small fee.
Oh my god, that would be amazing. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for in this week's Issue Review podcast, but as always, yeah, complete coverage of our HE news, features, culture, and of course books can be found in the magazine and on our website. We also value your input as well, so if you'd like to comment on any of the content of this week's edition, you can find us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and the like. Our website, of course, timeshighereducation.co.uk. UK. Alternatively, if you wish, you could send a letter via snail mail or to the email address the.letters@tesglobal.com. Please do get in touch. We always want to hear from you. Until next week, however, though, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.